Hey, well, I'm Mike Hagan, and I'm an assistant professor at Brandeis University, which is outside of Boston. And in my group, we look at different soft matter in biological systems. Quite a bit of our effort goes into understanding how viruses assemble. But I'll actually talk about something rather related but different today. Should I just start?
Yeah, why don't you start?
All right. And so this is work that was done by a grad student, Yasheng Yang, who now works for a hedge fund. So I'm sure he'll someday be richer than all of us.
Together.
Yes. And it's supported by the Brandeis Mercek. And so we're actually interested.
This hedge fund is supported by Brandeis Mercek.
I suspect nobody knows who his hedge fund is supported by, but no, this less remunerative work was supported by the Brandeis Mercek. And so what we're actually interested in is membranes that are constructed from a biopolymer. And that biopolymer is actually a filamentous virus that I'm showing here. It's called the FD virus. And this is a virus that is about a micron long, and it's about maybe 6 nanometers in diameter. And it has a persistence length, which is about comparable to its length. But for our purposes, we can just think of it as a rigid rod. Okay, and when this rod is suspended in solution, it's highly charged. And so it acts as a hard rod in solution. And so what I'm going to first introduce is some experiments by my collaborators, Vonimir Dojic, also at Brandeis. What they do is they put this virus in solution along with some kind of inert polymer, so it could be dextrin or PEO. And what this polymer does is it introduces depletion interactions between the rods. And so I'm assuming everyone is familiar with these depletion interactions. They arise due to entropy. And what they do is they induce an effective interaction between the rods. And the key points about the depletion interaction are that it's highly tunable. Its strength is proportional to the osmotic pressure of the polymer, so it increases with polymer concentration, and its range is essentially equal to the polymer size. Okay, so depending on the conditions, these viruses with the effective interactions assemble into a real panoply of different, I would say, wonderful structures.
Can you define again the length of the polymer versus diameter of your rod?
So we being Zvonimir, is going to vary the length scale of the polymer anywhere from about the diameter of the virus up to, say, 20 or 30 nanometers. And the length scale of the rod is a micron. The diameter of the virus, the bare diameter is 6 nanometers, and then as you vary salt concentration, you can change its effective hard core diameter from anywhere from around 6 nanometers up to 40 nanometers, and it's going to be about 8 nanometers for the conditions we're considering. Is that?
The polymer would be starting from that and going up.
Sorry, what?
The polymer size would be starting from a diameter like a
nanometers
and going up.
Yes.
And, well, is it a known model of depletion interaction between objects that are smaller than polymer familiar with depletion interaction between larger colloids when the depleter is a small piece than changing the story.
These are providing the depletion interaction. It's pretty well studied how the potential looks like.
If there are small particles that are smaller than my polymer, is there a depletion interaction between those?
No.
Since the fair comparison is a comparison between persistence length of depletant and the thickness of this virus, that's what will come.
So the important thing actually will be that the polymer, so what's going to happen is these viruses assemble into various structures. One of them are membranes like I show here. And the key for using the simple depletion interaction model is that the polymer gets excluded from the membrane or the, whatever assemblage the rod forms. And under the conditions we consider, except for I'll show you otherwise, that's the case. It's essentially pure rods in solution inside the assemblages and the polymers outside. And so basically, the polymer is exerting an osmotic pressure on this assemblage. Okay, so and so this is, the movie seems to have stopped playing, but this is what happens, and this is the structure that I'm going to focus on, and this happens at moderate osmotic pressures. It makes membranes which are many microns or millimeters in diameter and then a single rod length thick. Okay, and this is unusual because for our purposes, these are chemically homogeneous rods that are making these single monolayers.
Okay. In the previous diagram, what is the depth of this potential determined by the osmotic pressure and what volume?
It's basically equal to the osmotic pressure when put in the right units.
Well, that's my question about how you transfer osmotic pressure to units to get
energy. So I'll show you when we get to our computational model. This has all been measured by Parsegian for you know the particular polymer that you use because in our computational model we're going to treat this as
but
just
it's
a sphere.
It's like the Sanger volume of the rod.
What's that?
It's the Sanger volume of the rod times the pressure and it gives you the energy.
Yes. Okay, so this happens under moderate osmotic pressures. If you have lower osmotic pressures, the rods make just pneumatic tactoids, and this was actually studied by Paul and some of his friends. And if you go to higher osmotic pressures, you no longer get isolated monolayers, but they stack on top of each other. So they basically make smectic-like columns. And the question that was our job to answer was, why do you ever get this phase, right, where you get the isolated colloidal membranes? This, by the way, is what we call them, colloidal membranes. And the reason this is a question is because the same depletion interactions that are driving condensation into these membranes also bring about an attraction between membranes, which drives them to stack. And so the question is, why do you ever, at moderate osmotic pressures, not see this stacking? And there's a number of possibilities. One is simply that we didn't wait long enough because these move very slowly when they get to these large sizes. The other is there, in principle, could be attractions between end groups of the virus and the solvent or the polymer. And then the other possibilities have to do with the repulsions between membranes which arise from their undulations, either due to bending modes or rod protrusions. Okay, and so there's a number of different possibilities here, and it's very difficult to try to distinguish among these with experiments. And so that's why we needed to perform modeling, or of course we can do so.
I mean, yeah, it's just a surface energy, right? And then it looks as if the surface energy is relatively low for the tips, and it's very expensive to have sort of the sides exposed.
Yes, but why? That's the question that we need to answer, right? Because it's the same force that's giving this surface energy as it is that surface energy. Modulo these effects that I'm describing here. And so which of these effects is it that's controlling whether or not this stacking occurs? That's our question. Okay, and so we're going to use a computational model where we treat these as just rigid hard rods. And then we're going to model the effect of the polymer with so-called ghost spheres. What these are spheres which act as hard spheres when they interact with the rods, but they pass right through each other. And so this just gives us an ideal Van't Hoff osmolite, and so we know exactly what our osmotic pressure is. And then we're going to perform Monte Carlo simulations, and we control the osmotic pressure by controlling the chemical potential for the spheres. And you can get membranes if you do this. So this is just a picture of one sort of membrane that you get. And you see that some interesting things happen at the edge where the rods start to twist to try to minimize the interfacial free energy. But just doing a simulation like this, it's very hard actually to answer the question about kinetics because these membranes, of course, become very slow to relax in a simulation as well. Okay, and so to evaluate the thermodynamics of membranes versus stacking.
When you say you do Monte Carlo simulations, I mean, Monte Carlo, you've always got this question of time scale. I mean, so what sort of dynamics do you choose?
We're not actually interested in kinetics, and so we're just doing single particle moves here. So Yasheng came up with some clever ways to manipulate the ghost spheres efficiently, but basically we're moving single rods at a time. If we were interested in kinetics, you might be worried about that. But
you have also the parameter of concentration of neurons.
That's right, but
so how do you play with that?
We didn't play that carefully
because if you increase your bulk size, you're just always going to get one.
So basically, we look for parameters where
membrane, because there's no, I mean, the side energy is too high.
Yeah, so what we're going to do is we're going to make a phase diagram, and we chose a concentration of rods where you get membranes. The experiments are not particularly sensitive to the rod concentration in that the phase diagram is pretty well known, and there's a region of rod concentrations where this works, and it's a very large region. The reason it's a large region is because as soon as you're at high enough rod concentration, they get totally excluded from the polymer.
In experiments, they use high salt, so they kill the polar interactions?
They use salt such that they control the rod diameter to be, the effective rod diameter to be order, say, 8 nanometers. But they can vary that and still get this to work. You can get this to work over a pretty wide range of salt concentrations as well. All it does is change your effective thickness of the rods.
Is it monovalent salt or?
It's monovalent salt, yeah.
Okay.
So as far as we know, there's no.
They work at the bi-screening lens of what, about 4 nanometers?
At the salt concentrations they're using, the Debye length is probably about a nanometer. The effective diameter of the rod tends to be a bit bigger. It's not just the bare diameter plus the Debye length. It's a bit larger than that. But it's order that.
Okay. Can you explain why the device is larger than just barrel size?
I can't explain that easily, no. It's a pretty complicated calculation where you do the Poisson-Boltzmann equation. It's because you're dealing with interaction between two cylinders. So it comes out, you just ask, where is the interaction KT? And it comes out to something larger than just the barrel length plus the Debye length. Okay, so to actually calculate, what we really want is the thermodynamics of an isolated membrane versus stacking. And so the particular calculation we're going to do to assess that is we're going to do umbrella sampling, where we take two membranes and we calculate the free energy as a function of the separation distance between those membranes. So umbrella sampling, if you're not familiar, is just a way to calculate a free energy as a function of a reaction coordinate. And we use periodic boundary conditions because the real membranes are large compared, of course, to what we can simulate. Okay.
How do you move membranes as a whole before a potential acting on all rods at the same time?
Yeah, so we have a potential which acts, it can be either hard wall or harmonic as a function of the center of mass distance between two membranes. And that gets added into the potential you consider when you perform your Monte Carlo moves, and then when you're done, you cancel out the effects of that bias to get the physical free energy.
But so does that have periodic boundary conditions also in the sort of in the XY plane?
Just in the XY plane, right.
Which means you do not have a surface in the XY plane.
What do you mean? So yeah, right. We have a surface only in the Z plane. So the effects that we're looking at don't depend really on the size of the membrane. So we're specifically assessing the surface energy. Is this surface energy positive or negative? Because whether it stacks doesn't change, at least to first order, the energy of the edge, right? So that's not going to affect the thermodynamics.
What I would be looking for, I mean, you were showing sort of this phase diagram with different concentrations, and I mean, the experimental record is sort of it's clear. You show what
so I'll show you phase diagrams we get from the simulations, and then we'll compare them to phase diagrams from the experiments. And it might be easier to answer your question at that point. We're actually going to make a simplification for many of the simulations, and this is because so at this point, the only thing that can stabilize against stacking is these two undulation origin repulsions that I described due to the bending modes and protrusions of rods.
But is your membrane large enough to have several wavelengths of undulation?
So the answer to that is basically no, not at least the one I'm showing you here. We did do finite size scaling. What we actually found is the bending modulus of these membranes is huge because of a large aspect ratio. And so we theoretically calculated the repulsion due to bending modes versus protrusion modes. And at the separation distances which are relevant, the protrusion modes are many orders of magnitude stronger. And so we're actually going to be looking at just the effects of protrusion modes. And in many of the simulations, we actually made a simplification which guaranteed that that's the case because we don't allow orientational fluctuations of the rods. So this is something which might be questionable, but I'll show you in some cases we compared this to allowing these orientational fluctuations.
And you do this basically for computational to make things basically things happen quickly.
Yeah, it makes it much quicker and it allows you to parallelize it much better. Originally, we said the idea was to isolate the effect of the protrusion so that we could show protrusion effects alone are sufficient to give rise to stabilization. But the real reason is it's an awful lot quicker to simulate. So this is what you get if you do umbrella sampling. So here, this is the distance in rod diameters between the surfaces of two membranes. And this is the free energy per rod that we get. And these curves are different osmotic pressures. Remember, we control that via the chemical potential. And so at low osmotic pressure, you get a curve which monotonically increases. And so this is repulsive. Whereas these two curves at the higher osmotic pressures are attractive, because you can see a negative minimum there. And so what this means is that at these osmotic pressures, we're going to get smectic-like columns, but here we have actually isolated colloidal membranes are thermodynamically stable. And this dashed curve here is what you get if you relax this constraint on orientational fluctuations. And so really we had achieved our objective to a certain extent at this point because we showed that simply protrusion undulations alone are sufficient to make colloidal membranes thermodynamically stable. So, of course.
How do you estimate this number?
How do I estimate?
0.07.
This?
Right. Is there some theoretical estimate of why it is? I mean, this is presumably a functional ratio of the diameter of your rod to the size.
Oh, you mean where does it go from attractive to repulsive? Yeah, so we do have a theory to estimate that. It's so complicated that. Well, it's quite complicated, so I'm not showing you the theory. And so what I'm showing you here is simply a phase diagram where we performed simulations at all of these different parameters. And so in fact, what we did is we performed straightforward simulations to see if you get membranes at all. Basically, we throw all the rods in the box, and we ask, do they assemble into membranes? If not, then they form a pneumatic phase like this. Then when you go above this line, which is something that comes out of the theory, you find that you get membranes anywhere above this line. Between here and here, you get here isolated membranes and here smectic stacks. And so you see it does depend on the rod aspect ratio as well as the osmotic pressure. The interesting thing is that there's an aspect ratio at which these two lines intersect. And actually, so below this point, you go straight from the pneumatic phase to the smectic stacks. So there's a threshold aspect ratio below which you never see these isolated membranes. This was something that, in principle, they could test experimentally, but it turns out it's hard. They have some ability to control the aspect ratio, but it's difficult.
So, I mean, how does polydispersity affect this? Because
that's something that we're going to look at.
Because basically, if I think about the bending fluctuations, that's going to basically give you some essentially something like polydispersity, because you're going to get some...
Well, the bending fluctuations are so small at this aspect ratio that they really don't seem to have much of an effect.
The picture you showed of the virus looked, I mean...
Oh, you're asking about semi-flexibility?
Yes.
That we don't know. That's something that we're going to need to look at. So in the phase diagram that they've measured experimentally, semi-flexible rods versus hard rods, it basically widens the region in which you get condensation of rods in the various structures. But we don't know specifically how it affects the colloidal membrane. That's something we need to look at.
Flexibility very strongly suppresses this magnetic phase.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I would imagine. And I guess it is since they bend.
Yes. The effect's huge.
Yeah.
But they certainly get the smectic phase experimentally, so.
Right.
But there's another question. So you assume all rods of the same length, right? So what if there's some distribution in the length of the
So
rods?
That's what we're going to start looking at soon. Experimentally, they have very good control over that because these are a virus.
But because they bend, it's like they're fully dispersed in some.
To a certain extent.
To some extent, so.
Yeah.
It's probably more important. It's probably more interesting for you to do the same flexibility. I think that's really the important question.
Yeah.
Rather than the polydispersity.
Well, it's more interesting for us to do polydispersity in terms of actual length, because then they can experimentally compare those two things. But semi-flexibility is something that we should do mostly to see what its effect is. Yeah. Basically, they told us this is too hard to test this prediction experimentally, so we made another one where here we're varying now the length scale of the depletion interaction. So we're varying the sphere diameter. And what you find is that there's a threshold depletant size above which, again, you go straight from pneumatic to smectic. And we understand why this is, but I won't say that unless someone's interested. The interesting thing was this is something that can be checked experimentally. So they take rods of a particular aspect ratio and they vary the radius of gyration of their polymer.
How do you define concentration? Is it number density or the volume fraction?
This, I believe, is number density.
So by increasing radio, and when you're changing the sphere diameter to rod diameter, which one are you changing, the sphere or rod? Because if you're...
We're changing the sphere. So
basically, in going that way, you're going to fully filling space with your both spheres.
Well, you're getting closer to doing that, yes. The osmotic pressure isn't changing, but you are... and remember, the ghost spheres, they don't interact with each other, so you have no excluded volume effects. So this acts like still an ideal osmolite, even as you start to fill space.
So is that why you don't have this alternating rod-sphere smectic?
They don't see that in their experiments.
No, this is a simulation by Toda, I think, going back.
These I don't know about.
Mid-80s or something.
I think you have to go to very different conditions. So these are things Frayden has seen, and it depends on, I think you have to be different ratios of sphere size to aspect ratio to get that.
Well, these spheres don't interact with themselves, so there's no way you can get array of spheres because they take most...
Yeah, so you're not going to see that here, but they don't see it in the experiments either. Now, that is one of the many list of things that we plan to try is what happens when the spheres start to interact with themselves. But in the experiments, for the experiments that we're trying to model, the right model to use, because the polymers they're not perfect ideal osmolites, but that's the way that they act.
I want to return to the question which Michael asked at the beginning. Those are not spheres, really, but coils.
Yes.
So I imagine that if you have some forest of your rod, then the coil can actually be in between of them.
So you get a problem if the rod is too thin in comparison to the size of the radius of gyration. That's right. And you get a problem actually if the radius of gyration is too small compared to the electrostatic length scale that's separating the rods. So what becomes a problem is the latter. So they only go up to size about 18, and it may be that you get some effect of the rods interpenetrating the polymers here, but it doesn't seem to be the case because the polymers are still completely excluded from the rod assemblages. And so at that point, once you have an assemblage of rods, it can't go in between the polymers, right? But it isn't, so it may affect the osmotic pressure, but the osmotic pressure is still going to increase with polymer concentration. You do get a problem at small polymer sizes because once the polymer gets to a diameter where it can go in between two rods, because remember that rods exclude each other with this electrostatic length scale, but the polymer is neutral. It doesn't see the electrostatic length scale. And so if this distance between the bare diameter of rods is large compared to the polymer size, the polymers will go inside the assemblage at that point. And we see evidence of that because here what I'm showing you is the experimental phase diagram where they're varying the polymer radius of gyration. And I'll show you in a second that it matches our prediction. What you see is a dramatic increase in the osmotic pressure you need in order to get membranes at small polymer sizes. And that's because they're intercalating between the rods there.
But in your model, you don't have this.
We could, but we didn't want.
You have hard cylinders, so you don't have this next scale. Of
exactly, and that's why we don't see that increase in our model. But you do see it in the experiments. What we're interested in is what happens in this direction. And so here, again, these crosses are the isolated membranes. These are the smectic stacks, and these are pneumatics. And you see you go from a depletant size where you have isolated membranes to one where you go directly from pneumatic to smectic stacks. And so somewhere in between here and here is where the threshold polymer size that we predicted is. Unfortunately, there's no experiments to narrow down exactly where that is because there turn out to be no PEO polymers with sizes that are commercially available within this range. And so you redid the experiments with dextrin and you find the same problem. You get exactly the same sort of phase diagram and in exactly the region where this transition occurs, there's no sizes available.
Why there's no sizes?
That I don't know. The people who synthesize these polymers apparently go straight from 9 to whatever this is. So they just, these are the molecular weights that they're able to
sizes.
Find.
You can get them in any, you can fraction them in any size. I mean, we have them in steps of like 2 nanometers.
Yeah, from 20 to 15.
Oh, yeah? 15 steps of 2.
Oh, that would be interesting then. Maybe I should have them contact you. They say they tried very hard. Do you have PEO?
We have some dextrin.
Dextrin is different because it's branched.
Is it better for you?
Well, I don't know if it's better, but they ran into the same problem. So where this hole is in dextrin, I don't know. I should have them contact you, though. Maybe you have a better supplier than they do. It's okay. This is basically the end. Is that what you're telling me?
so much. How far dispersed are these polymers? That surely should be important as well.
I don't actually know. I think it's pretty well controlled.
They're pretty well dispersed.
Well dispersed, I would think, yes.
Yeah, not very well dispersed.
So if you tell, say 10, it's probably between 6 and 15.
So that's, of course, also something we didn't ask. If you vary the size of the, if you have polydispersed spheres, my feeling is that it's mainly going to be the mean diameter of the depletant that's controlling things. And so as you change the mean diameter in this direction.
Well, but that would depend how close you are to the crossover, to the semi-dilute regime, I suppose.
Of the
polymer.
Yeah, you don't want to be in the semi-dilute regime of the polymer, I don't think.
10 kilopascal, where would be the normal concentration for your 18?
What's that?
If you go at 10 kilopascal, at your top of your line, if you go this way, what size corresponds to overlap concentration?
I don't recall. So we looked at the actual osmotic pressure for this polymer, and you're certainly in a region where it's not going by the Van't Hoff law. But I don't off the top of my head remember where the overlap concentration is. It's actually, I think it's not, I think you're okay if you're in the semi-dilute polymer region. It's just affecting the osmotic pressure equation of state. You still get that the rods and polymer exclude each other, which is all that we really care about.
Right. Can you explain what you mean by OK?
Can I explain what I mean by what?
OK. If I have two rods in semi-dilute solution and the correlation length is not that large, why would there be any depletion interactions?
So if you go too concentrated.
What does two mean? What length scales are we comparing to this fiber?
I'm not sure that we know exactly. What I know is that in these experiments, you can observe that your rods are completely excluded from the polymers. So if you're asking at what polymer concentration is that not going to happen, I'm not
asking about number. I'm asking about the physical phenomenon.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to completely guess because I don't actually know. What you need is the best guess I can give you is that the mesh size in your polymer, when that's getting comparable to the some size of your rod, you're going to run into problems. But you know that's a guess because these are pretty complicated. People like to think about these as pairwise interactions between rods that come about from the depletion interaction. And it's not obvious to me that that's the right way to think about it when you have these high-density assemblages of rods. I'm pretty sure that...
I'm thinking about the pair first. If you notice that the pair interactions would be hard to grow to assemble.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a simple model for depletion rods, depletion potential, and functional concentration for semi-dilute solutions?
I'm not sure about for semi-dilute solution. It's been measured. I think it's been done for dilute solution of polymers, and I'm not sure it's been done for semi-dilute.
Well, I think that you said correctly that the only question is what the amount of, assuming that your polymer is excluded from your pancake or whatever it is, the only question is what is osmotic pressure.
But
the degree to which it is excluded is a different story.
That I think they can see pretty well experimentally because you can separate these membranes very easily from solution, and then you can check how much polymer is in them. And they seem to be quite excluded. This is why we didn't look too carefully into whether it's semi-dilute or how that affects the depletion, because we know the osmotic pressure.
Okay, so
wait, you have to be recorded.
Oh, yes, I have to be recorded.
long as I'm not waterboarded, I don't. Okay, so kind of want to tell you some of the stuff we've been doing recently in my group, looking at collective behavior of swimming microorganisms. And, well, I'll just go and we'll go along and just let you know what you're doing. So, essentially, there's been a fair bit of work recently.
Sorry, can you move your computer because you're...
Okay, sorry.
Better move it.
Just, yes, whether or not...
Move it to the other day. Yeah, like this, okay, that's all. Leave it.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so... There's, if you want, been a fair bit of experimental progress recently looking at collective behavior of swimming organisms. And so we thought we'd have a go. Now, if I want to go back in time somewhat, there's been a fair amount of work done looking at flocking transitions. So looking at, if you want, flocks of birds, fish, and such things. And there are these, what do you call it, Vixek models, or what type, where you say I have some object which is swimming, and it is, it basically looks at its neighbors, and then it does some kind of averaging, and then says, okay, I'll go along the average of where everybody's going. And such models are known to undergo transitions from states where everything is swimming in a disordered fashion to states where they're swimming coherently. And at the same time, if we look at some recent experiments looking at sort of bacterial suspensions, so this is an experiment from Ray Goldstein's lab. You sort of see that, well, if you look at so what they've done is a velocity map of the flow field of the bacteria, and what you see is something which is rather complicated, and some people have called it bacterial turbulence. It is not really clear if this system really is at all anything like this. So in some sense, what we want to understand was, do bacteria undergo such intrinsic collective behavior? The bacteria are not the only microorganisms. So there are several sort of various microorganisms of the scale of, let's say, a micron or so. And I'm going to take two examples. For example, Chlamydomonas, for example, which is an algae which has two arms which it uses to swim, and let's say your E. coli, whatever it is, which is your classical bacteria, it's got a bacteria and it's got some flagella. And if we look at the flow field of this object, for the bacteria, if I was to put a sort of vector pointing out from the center, I've got the average flow field looks like a dipole with the forces pointing outwards, whilst for the Chlamydomonas, the algae, because I've got this sort of swimming-like behavior, I have essentially a force dipole in which the forces are coming inwards. So we can, if you want, try to classify these systems this way. So we're going to put these in a class where we've got the forces pushing outwards. We're going to call them pushers, and these we're going to call pullers. The other thing that we need to think about, if we think about these objects, is, well, their shape and how they interact with the flow. In liquid crystalline, people will know that if you've got a liquid crystalline object in a flow, you can have, they will align at some angle, if there's a, if they are flow aligning liquid crystals, or they will tumble. So basically, your director, if you apply shear flow, the director will not align with the flow, but will actually tumble. Okay, so those are the ingredients of the thing. So
the four cases, just pullers, tumblers, and non-tumblers.
Yes. Okay. Now, so then experimentally, what can be measured? So as I mentioned before, you can ask the questions whether or not this object goes in some kind of ordered phase, whether you've got some broken symmetry. So essentially, you can measure correlations between, so the swim direction basically determines a vector, so it's swimming in some direction, that determines the director. So you can measure correlations, and for us, very interestingly, you can measure the effective viscosity of the suspension. And as I said, we'd like to figure out if there is there some flushing phase transition as these transition models show? And if there is, how could it develop? And can we understand that using a physical theory? And going back to that sort of complicated flow field, can we characterize that steady state? So, just an example of rheological experiments. Two experiments, which I just picked at random. So this experiment is essentially measuring the, if you want, the effective viscosity of a solution of this Bacillus subtilis. So it's a bacteria which is rod-like, which has some flagella. And it's a rather nice, elegant experiment. They make a thin film of this suspension, and then they create a vortex by putting magnetic beads and then applying a magnetic field. And then by looking at the radius of the vortex, how the velocity scales, you can pull out a viscosity. And so what you see here is they've got the viscosity as a function of the number density of the. It's a thin film, so obviously, but the thickness is probably several.
I'm thinking about bacteria, do they swim under each other, do they swim all in
time? Okay, so that's interesting. So there's actually a profile of bacteria across the film. So actually, you tend to find that they tend to aggregate near the surface. So you have a higher density close to the surface than in the middle. Okay, so it's
both surfaces or just top
surface? Both surfaces. Okay, so there's a great, and so that's already, so it's not a homogeneous system. So you've got to, so that's already something which one doesn't worry about. But anyway, the point is that so measure the viscosity of Bacillus subtilis, and here something weird is happening, because once you get a lot of these bacteria together, then they go into a different phase where they start forming a colony. So essentially, you should really look here. At low densities, so at low densities,
this is number density bacteria.
What you have here is just water or the fluid with the nutrients, and as you increase the number of bacteria, then the viscosity goes down.
Funny. The fact that they assemble near the surface, is it for pushers or pullers? Because they think that one of them should attract to the surface and the other should repel from the surface.
I think the reason why they attract to the surface is because of there's oxygen gradients, and the reason is really to do with. I'm not sure it's a chemical reason why they aggregate to the surface.
But the other surface is solid surface, no?
No, it's a film. So it's a film. So the experiment really is it's actually this. Okay. Something like that. Because of course you're gonna get a meniscus of extension. So that's what you have. Okay, so this is way too detailed.
but the interesting thing is because they swim and they swim actively, they reduce viscosity.
Exactly. First thing is that you say, what I have is I have a suspension. So if I take Einstein, whatever it is, it should go up.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? Because it's just 1 plus phi to some whatever the constant is, which I don't know.
Frogs, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's going down. So you've got a suspension which is less viscous than the solvent.
Tell me where. I mean, since you don't know very well your size of your object, where would be the Einstein line on this plot? Is it going to be way to the right, or is it basically where? Where is the? I mean, where would be the volume fraction of this object being approximately 10% is where on this axis?
What I'm saying is Einstein would just say you have something going up.
No, but yeah, I mean, it goes up by a factor of 2 approximately when you get to volume fraction of 10% or something, right?
Mm-hmm,
it's 0.5.
Yeah. Okay.
So my question is, what is the? I mean, if you convert the x axis to volume fraction, what number would you get?
So
giving us in 10 to the 10th centimeters minus 3, you have to introduce the volume of your bacteria to multiply it to get dimensions.
Yeah, so the volume of the bacteria is basically, I guess it's about a micron, diameter is maybe 10 nanometers.
How far apart are they?
You're in a dilute regime here. You're not.
So they're very, very far apart.
The distance between them is larger than the diameter.
So from the point of view, Einstein, we're completely flat.
Yeah.
So there would be basically a horizontal line.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now. So that's that. So that's so. I mean, only. So the only thing I kind of want you to focus on is this. Okay, that it's lower, because as you will see, there are so many issues that we cannot address that. So we really only want to understand order one effects. Okay. So then we have the Plamen-Monas in that case, and so here they've done a more, if you want, for different experiments, so they do different things. But they've done a more, if you want, closer comparison to the Einstein theory. So they're basically, so what they've done is they've taken dead cells and measured the viscosity. And of course, as you expect, it goes up, and there's okay, whatever it is. And then the swimming cells. And of course, the swimming cells now are more viscous. So basically, so we have exactly this opposite, that the so in some sense we've got the behavior behaving okay, it's increasing, but it's increasing higher than a passive system.
So you're confusing me at least. And the top plot you're showing is decreasing, and the bottom plot you're showing is increasing. So which one is it?
So there are two. So this one is Bacillus subtilis, which was.
But they don't have the same plot.
Huh?
They don't have the same plot because here the volume fraction is huge.
Yes, I mean so. Yeah, so I'm asking a qualitative question here. Okay, so the question. Okay, so I. So, this is so for me, plus.
Okay.
Minus plus. I mean that's the only thing. That's the only thing. Yeah.
But in the upper case, it goes up eventually, and by the time you arrive to a volume fraction of 5%, I actually calculated its volume fraction in the upper plot is 10 to minus 5. Mm-hmm. So it's...
Well, it depends how many microns each one is.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I said if it's 1/10 of a micron, it will be 10 to minus 2, if it's full microns.
Yes.
It's very, very small. Mm-hmm. It looks like, at least if we take into account the last point, which is at the biggest end, it is already bigger than the original viscosity. So
on the bottom plot, if you zoom in at the 0, 0, is there actually a dip in the beginning?
Yeah, maybe.
Especially on a logarithmic scale. If you are saying that we are very dilute there, is this dip just is lost in this little?
Okay, there is an issue here about whether or not we, to make the comparison, I guess one has to really to compare the lower half.
Would you just see the same scale?
Yeah. For us it's just, let's just talk about the signs.
Okay.
Yeah. We can argue about the numbers later. Okay. So I'm kind of, the kind of framework I want to try to study this is really this, to think about these things as, if you want, active liquid crystals. So what do we have here? I mean, there are various examples, but if you want the case we have here, we have some objects which are polar, so they're whatever it is, and they're active, and we have some density variations. So we'd like to describe this system. And how do we do that? Well, we need to identify some degrees of freedom that we want to use. So we've got this bunch of arrows, each of our objects, and so we, so I can think about if they align, I can form some polarized state where there's some local polarization vector. Or they could align this way, where the arrows, the head direction of the arrows don't matter. So essentially, I've got double-headed arrows, so I guess you could be thematic. And I've got conserved quantities like density, which will also be hydrodynamic, so which will be slow. So if I wanted to construct a long wavelength theory of this system, I would use these variables to construct it. And so let's try to do that. Okay? So basically we've coarse-grained the system, and so the only variables that we have are some local density of these objects. We have a local director, and we have, of course, momentum. Okay? Moment density, which is, of course, conserved. And if we have a conserved quantity, then it's going to satisfy some conservation law. So you've got this, you've got some currents. So we have the currents. If you want, we can split them into three bits. We have the normal bits, which you have, let's say, for a whatever dead system, and we have some terms which are due to the fact that you have a living system. This, and similarly for the stress tensor, we're going to have some normal, if you want, stress tensor, the normal stress tensor viscosity, and we have also additional stresses. And the important thing here is that these objects have, I can construct, there's a stress tensor, there will be a force density, which will be the force multiplied by the still separation between the force and the size of the object. And so since the force is going to be along its director, I've got something which is going to generate for me something which looks like a tensor which has this orientation in it. And in some sense, this is the key thing. And then, so there's sort of... and one can then ask, what does the system do? And so now let's ask about, for example, just saying what would a polar phase look like? So we have, some director, and we allow some small fluctuations, and we ask, are these fluctuations stable? And essentially, as a result of this additional term in the stress tensor, then essentially the director or orientation director becomes unstable to fluctuation to modulations. So essentially, the ordered phase is not stable. So essentially, if you started off with such objects of swimmers, then they would go unstable because of this pumping of the objects. I guess the one point I just want to make is that, so that means that, I mean, but you could stabilize them by confinement. Okay.
By that you mean the critical activity level, you have a finite level, critical activity level with a finite size system.
Yes. So if you have an, so essentially it says if you have an infinite system, then it'll be unstable. But if you have a finite system, then you, it's possible to stabilize it.
But the unit of confinement length is smaller than the unstable period, otherwise, right next to the
So
if it's not confined, then it becomes turbulent?
So in some, well, if it's not confined, then we don't know what to do. So I would say, so this is question number one. What is that state? So we can only define well-defined state if it's confined. But if it's not confined, then
limit cycle or something.
Could be some complicated limit cycle. Who knows? I certainly don't know. I don't know of anybody who's been able to convince me otherwise. Okay, so, but anyway, since we can have that confinement, then at least we can ask questions if it's confined.
Can you define viscosity for the system?
Well, exactly. So the problem is you can only define a viscosity if it's confined.
But if it's confined, but it's if you don't apply this as force, it will still be mobile. How can you define viscosity?
So you can only define. I'm coming.
Okay.
So essentially, you can only define this thing if things are confined. So the question then is, one question you can ask is, how do you get an ordered state of this object? So I mean, is it even reasonable for us to think about this system being an ordered state? Maybe an ordered state is not the right way to think about it. And of course, so the way we need to do that is we need to have a sort of to link some way that what's happening macroscopically to what's happening macroscopically. So let's try to, at least, so that's what we've been trying to do. And the way we do it is we start off, this is our, we can break our swimming object into a bunch of, if you want, beads, if you want Stokeslets, and we have some Langevin equation for these beads. They're coupled hydrodynamically, and we're treating beads as a point force. We have the Racine tensor which links them, and we also have some fluctuating forces. These fluctuations will have some thermal fluctuations, but also the fluctuations which are chemical because of this activity of this material. So in some sense, those are the ingredients. We have some deterministic bit which is coming from the swimming cycle, and you have some fluctuations. And from that, you can define essentially some center and some orientation, and we can write down some density for finding a number of particles which have some position and orientation, and of course, which will combine the deterministic thing with the digital, somehow how it swims. Plus,
how do you distinguish pushers from pullers?
Okay, so let me go on. So basically, this is a general framework to describe these systems. Okay, so now we need.
So far, it's passive.
So far, it's just a beads with a. The only thing is that the deterministic thing can be time dependent. So if it's time dependent, then we can. And from that, you can get some equations for this. So I don't want to go. So how do we do this? We need to come up with a model for the swimmer. So we've played with a bunch of different models, and a particularly nice model has been induced by Golestanian and Najafi. So effectively speaking, I mean, your swimmer is made up of three beads. Yeah. Question. So the swimmer is made up of three beads, and these beads are undergoing some periodic motion, which is time reversal asymmetric. Because, of course, we know from Lorentz number that if you do something that way and you do it back, you'll come back to where you started from. Okay, so basically one way of doing this is to put in some phase difference between the motion of these two arms. So this thing has got basically two arms, and these arms are undergoing some motion. And, there's some details here. So we did it for a thin film, but we also did it for bulk. And it's interesting about this model is that because it's so simple, you can calculate everything. And so it's really nice. So you can even do things non-perturbatively. We've just done it perturbatively here. So you can, for example, calculate. So, for example, let's assume that the two arms are doing this type of motion. So one arm is is essentially the out of phase. The out of phase, so one arm is, when one arm is moving, the other one is moving plus, the other one is moving in the minus direction.
Where it is written that they are out of phase. Oh, cosine.
Cosine sine. Yeah. So there's a phase, you can write a general formula and you can show that this portion of the phase difference. Okay. So essentially the velocity, you can calculate the velocity and you can calculate the average force density as well for this object. So, and you can do this, and what you find is that the force density depends on the ratio of these two, the ratio of the rest length of these two arms. So with this prescription, where we've got this cosine and sine, it moves in this direction, and we can expand this, the force density of this object, and what you find is that there is a dipole term and a quadrupole term, and essentially based on the ratio of the rest length of the two arms, if this so as I said, it's moving in this direction with this prescription. So basically, with this particular prescription, if you change the prescription, you'll get a slightly different thing. You find that if this ratio is less than one, it's a pusher, and if it's bigger than one, it's a puller.
Just for if I change my definition of time, cosine becomes sine becomes minus cosine, so it really doesn't matter, right? It's still going to be the same.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm going to say is that the difference, important thing here is the phase difference.
Okay, it's always going to be one slightly ahead of the other.
Yes, that's important. The only thing is the phase difference, okay? What I'm saying is that if you choose different phase, then it'll swim in a different direction. I mean, you can change the direction, which it swims by changing your, there, okay? So the one point is the nice thing about this model is that this model now allows one to tune between the pusher and puller case. And it also and the point where you have k is one, then you have a quadrupolar swimmer. So it's not a dipole anymore; it's a quadrupolar, it's a swimmer. And actually, there are many examples of that. For example, a chemical swimmer, where you've got an object which has there are these Janus particles. So these Janus particles, where you coat, let's say, what's that, with some catalyst. Such things are quadrupolar. The flow field is quadrupolar. So therefore, I mean, so it's sort of so interesting. So this model is very nice because it allows one, and it's very nice. So it allows ones to really scan through the things.
But it still swims in the direction of two.
Sorry?
It still swims in the same direction.
Yes.
Of the sign. Okay.
Yes, that's the point. So the direction is fixed by choosing the phase, and then after that, the ratio determines now whether what the force average force density is. Okay, so basically we can now take this swimmer and put it into our model. So we have this with this general, and we can sort of, if you want, we can crank the handle. And so we can generate some equations for these densities, which will include all the bits. You have the active term coming from the forces, and you have, and what you find is that you have essentially some, we can write it as some currents. This is fluctuations. The thermal fluctuations and non-thermal fluctuations. This is the self-propulsion. This is the average V, which is coming from the fact that that's coming from whatever it is, this property of the swimmer. And we also have some interaction coming from the other swimmers, which is coming here, which is obtained by essentially, which is due to the hydrodynamic coupling. So this comes from hydrodynamic coupling. So essentially you can get, now we have a thing, and from this now we can project onto these degrees of freedom that we started off with.
You do not consider the possibility that hydrodynamic coupling affects the motion of particles inside each swimmer. Each swimmer does its own thing independently of that.
At this point, we haven't, but subsequently we've done that.
I see.
Okay, so you can actually make a model where. You don't specify, so this model essentially is defined by specifying, you specify this. Mm-hmm. Or you can make a model where you specify where its force is. And then you can and you can get corrections to that. We've done that, but it's messy, so I don't want to get into that here. Okay, so basically, now, if you do this in three dimensions, you can calculate, do this thing, do the whole thing. And actually, then you can then look for the bulk mean field equations. And there's no long range order. The mean field equations give you no long range order. They just, and essentially, it's because the hydynamic, it's a central force action. So when you do the averaging over that, they just basically doesn't, they don't align. So essentially, you, so there's no global order. So the, even at the idea of expanding about an ordered phase, you start wondering whether this is a good approximation. Maybe it's, maybe it's, I mean, that's.
What about 2D?
Okay, so 2D, of course. This is the story. So so basically, we were looking for, is there any situation where it happened, where this interaction, and in 2D, if you, in this problem where you have a thin film where I have two buckles, then it is possible to get a mean field equation which will give you order. However, but then.
2D for liquid.
2D for the liquid. So basically, going back, let's go back here. Okay, so let's take, so I mean, so let's, so 3D, because these are the same. This NE is same as that. That's the 3D case. But the 2D case, now we have, let's, we have some viscous liquid surrounded by that. So there's going to be some length scale which is determined by the ratio of the viscosities and the size of the object. And you can get 2D-like hydrodynamics if you're below that length scale, and the 3D-like hydrodynamics if you're above that length scale. So basically, you can do the same thing. So, which is kind of what we've done. And in that case, indeed, for pushes, one does find a transition to an ordered phase, enigmatic and polar phase. For pullers, not. Though this, in this model, this is a rod-like object, so it actually has a particular flow aligning property. So it actually flow align, it aligns with the flow. So it's possible if you had something which was where you played with that, that you can also get these to go unstable. But anyway, so basically what happens is, so you do find an ordered phase, but only for the pushers. Then we can do the same thing that we talked about before and check whether this ordered phase is stable. And
sorry, it's ordered in pneumatic or it's polar?
So it's so both. So basically, and again, it depends on details of the swimmer, basically. So basically, depending on what your ratio of those length scales are. So you can switch. So in this case, with the parameters we've chosen here, it goes first to pneumatic and then to a polar phase.
And it doesn't, there's no interactions between.
So this is where in the dilute regime, so we basically ignore hardcore interactions. So yeah, there is bulk order. So you think, okay, fine. Then let's look and see what happens when we check whether it's stable, and it's unstable. So it's less, it's, this instability is weaker. So we can, so I mean, so we, you can do a sort of linear stability analysis compared to what I talked about before. So the this was done by Sriram Ramaswamy almost 10 years ago now. And what you find for that case was that you had a very strong instability, which was length scale independent. Here it's weaker, but it's still there. So essentially, it is possible to get some long range order, but it's not stable. So you kind of still have the same issue. So it's a soft mode, it's soft instability, but it's that. So what's the summary at this point? Summary at this point is, it does not seem obvious that there is an ordered state for these systems. Because whenever we're not able to find a stable ordered state. So it looks like this whatever the state is, it's not ordered. It's very hard to ask about how to share them. I mean, sharing them, because basically, I mean, if we don't know what the state is, how can we perturb it? But if they're confined, then one can share it. So let's confine it, which is what we did. Now, and essentially, you Now imagine, so we confine it. So if we confine it, you can stabilize basically the director. Now you can stabilize the director to let it to be aligned along here. If this length is small enough, smaller than this, the active length scale. And now the argument. Now, and there's a very simple argument which will not help us understand why this case, where for the pullers the viscosity went up and the viscosity went down, because essentially if you apply a shear, you have some additional stress coming from this force dipole that's coming from the swimmer. It goes like this alpha pi pj, and you could, if you wave your arms about, you can do this a bit better. We have done it a bit better. But if you wave your arms around roughly, which is what was done in this paper, you can essentially see that there will be, you can think about some increase in the viscosity, which is proportional to this active stress. And since this sign of this thing since one case you have a force dipole which is positive, other case a force dipole which is negative, then actually this correction will be positive or negative depending on the nature of the swimmer. But as I said, that's not quite right, because we've ignored how this swimmer behaves in the flow. So actually, that's really quite important. And essentially, well, I don't want to kind of get. What you find is that if you look at the, if it is floor lining, then right, you'll have an increase of the viscosity if you have a puller and decrease if it's a pusher. But if it's tumbling, then things are switched around. If it's tumbling, then the pusher will have the increase in viscosity and the puller the decrease. And I mean, again, you can sort of get a feel for the flow field. So imagine now we have a pusher aligned in the flow field, and this is a pusher aligned in a shear. Now you see that and a puller which is tumbling. So let's say which is at some different angle to the flow field, and you see that the local hydrodynamic flow fields, these things do look quite similar. Okay, so essentially there is this duality. It's not just the pusher or puller, but also whether or not the object floor aligns or not. We did some stuff about non-linear rheology. Okay, so I kind of just gave a kind of rather scatterplot thing, but I just kind of wanted to show a sort of where we are. So there are just lots and lots of questions. I mean, so things are very unclear. We still can't characterize the steady state. So we have a quality picture of the rheology, which is based on the perceived picture of the ordered state, but experiments clearly show an unordered state, so it's not really clear whether that's the case. Also, in the experimental things we actually talk about, if you look at the experiments show the rheology is very nonlinear, so you have shear thinning. And also, if you look at they also looked at the dynamics of the swimmers within the flow field, and actually, what you find is that in the puller suspensions, which is, in my opinion, a more detailed paper, they found out that, for example, dead swimmers flow align, whilst living ones do not. So the dead ones align with the flow, whilst living ones actually seem to spend 70% of their time swimming against the flow. So the models we've talked about assume there was one flow aligning parameter which was fixed. And the activity was only affecting the stress, but actually it clearly shows that the flow line behavior is also affected by activity. So really, they're just saying, so we could say that you have a qualitative picture of whether or not the thing increases or decreases, but there are so many assumptions which are clearly wrong there that it really requires. I mean, I would say we need help. So anyway, stop there.
Obviously, the main question is whether the number of wrong assumptions is odd or even.
Even.
We did a similar thing.
But in this simple model of swimmer, the Golestanian model of sine and cosine, do they align in the shear flow or do they not?
They align to the shear flow. Yes. So this simple model that we have aligns in the shear flow, yes.
And they do it not in collective fashion, but each of them?
Yes, with each of them, yes. It's a rod, basically, so it just...
It aligns just as a rod? With the fact that it's active rod does not affect...
It does, at least, we've done some small simulations of small numbers of the object, and they seem to align with the flow. Of course, you know that if you have a rod which has a finite aspect ratio, it undergoes Jeffrey orbits.
Yeah.
So there is also the ratio that if once the shear rate becomes high enough, then it will no longer it doesn't align. So you know that that's for any rod, if the shear rate is high enough, it doesn't align because the rod start performing these orbits.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of well known thing. So but if it depends on the aspect ratio. So there's depending on the shear rate and aspect ratio.
For small shear
it aligns. For large shear, of course, eventually it will not.
The transition from shear aligning to tumbling for the rod, if you have this type of active motion, does it become more stable for shear aligning or does it become more tumbling? If you just take a rod and put a shear and then it turn on the swimming.
Yeah. Well, this is a one-dimensional swimmer. So essentially, all you do, it's like a rod whose length is changing in size. So you're changing the aspect ratio. So the effective aspect ratio is smaller than if let's average over a cycle.
I'm more worrying about the tumbling frequency and the oscillation frequency, whether it goes into resonance.
I mean, okay, of course, lots of things are possible. So, I mean, but if we apply a low shear rate, and we can think of this object as being essentially averaging, we can think of averaging over several cycles. So this thing has an average size, which is length, which is less than the maximum length. And that's the length that you would put into your Jeffrey orbit calculation to figure out the stability of whether or not it aligns or when it tumbles.
And if there is no external strain rate, is there stress in the system when it's swimming in a small confined geometry? Do you have stress as you...
For every swimmer, I have, I have that, so therefore there will be contribution to the stress, which is going to be F times A.
I'm thinking more about macroscopic system, right?
Yeah.
If I have many swimmers, if there is a flow of swimmers, but I don't have external strain rate applied to the system. I'm just asking whether there is a normal Newtonian relation between stress and strain rate. If you have active system, do you get the stress at zero strain rate?
Of course, everything is set by the bounding conditions. If you have a set a parallel plate, if you're below this stability threshold, then it's linear. But once you go above the stability threshold, which is something I didn't, then very weird things happen. So everything depends on the. Okay, so pretty much. So if you are if you're below, so this is when you're cracking up activity. Now we basically have this finite thing, and we start making it more active. Okay, so this case here is the yeah. Okay, and then as we do it, so basically you get some shift, and once you get there is some critical value of activity where all of a sudden this state here is unstable. Like that means the state where you've got a stationary material is unstable, and so this looks like the shear banding. So you would say, well, okay, this is unstable. My state, which is stationary, is unstable. So I'm going to flip into some state where I got half of the thing flowing that way and half.
You're going much further than I was asking. I was asking whether I can go off into gamma dot, which is not zero.
If activity is slow, there's no problem. If it's big, there is a problem because then the steady state is no longer a stationary state is a state which has flows in it. So therefore, you know, so basically in that case, it's clearly not. So if its activity is weak, then it's you can think of it as small perturbation of your normal system. If it's strong, then you get very, essentially you get banded, like a banded flow.
Okay. I forgot to watch the time. So
that's not fair.
That's very unfair. I apologize.
Yeah, so in any case, that's kind of what I'm working on. And obviously, as I said, there are lots of interesting things here. We've also looked at different models of swimmers. So we also looked at, we look at different models of swimmers as well, which some of which are more similar to the Chlamydomonas than the bacteria and things like that. So happy to discuss with anybody later on.
All right.
Ah, you're going to use it?
Okay.
And you're next.
Thank you.
Blessing.
Inspires, yes.
Okay, meanwhile, he's doing this. I can talk about more food. We need to sort some things out. Okay, so first, we are 17 people now, and there are some new faces here. And you can go to the wiki and sign up, or you can come to me. I'm not sure exactly which room I'm in. I think it's like...
I'm just going to see whether I'm going to open Keynote. Should I?
You can do it.
Yeah. Okay, there it is.
Sign up for what?
Food.
Let me just close PowerPoint.
Food.
We should be more specific about what we mean by food.
Oh, eat. Or what do you do with food? I'm joking.
Okay, food fire.
Well, since you
are
like,
food fire,
you
yeah, sure.
No, okay, well, I don't, so I'll leave it to you. You
want to take it down? So it's 7:30. I've reserved a table for 20 people, and we are 17, but we can definitely extend that. And it's at Goleta Beach Park Cafe and Bar, and it takes 14 minutes, according to Google Maps, to walk there along the beach.
It's tomorrow.
It's tomorrow, right. But there's one thing we need to sort out. Since there are so many, we can only have one bill. So either you will bring money, or I can pay and you will bring money to me. I don't know which is the best thing. But I looked at the prices. So you can buy meat for $70 to $27. There's fish for $20 to $30. You can have pasta for about $20. And appetizer is about $10 and so on. So I think that you should land on the order of about $30. So either you bring the money there and we make a big pile and it is given to them, or be given to me. I don't know which is the best thing to do. Or any other who would like to pay, you can also do that, of course. I don't have to do that. Are there any suggestions of how we should solve it?
Can't we just divide by N when we get there?
Sorry?
Just divide the price by N when we get there?
We can do that.
Isn't that easy?
But then, yeah.
I don't know.
I think everyone understands that everyone has to pay, so
right.
It works.
Good, so that would bring cash. Right.
So that's capitalist system.
Yeah. And I will not go there myself. I have to the drive and so on. So I don't know, are you walking maybe? Because you have been there.
It's very hard to miss. You go to the ocean, turn left.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're here. Just walk. You will.
Yeah, but you will never know. Random walk.
That's one dimensional walk.
It's even on this map. Check it out.
Is it down by the public place?
Sorry,
it's
working hint. If you miss it, then you will cross the river without a bridge. Cross the river without a bridge, that means you are too far.
If you wet, you're too far.
Okay, so then bring money then, and then we will have fun tomorrow.
American cars.
American cars.
What is it called, the restaurant?
Galeta Beach Cafe and Grill.
Galeta Beach
Restaurant. Yeah. Galeta Beach Cafe Grill.
On the wiki, there is a link to the restaurant.
Unfortunately, there is no link on wiki that you can eat there. Okay, so I see.
All right, so time for me to start. I'm kicking myself here that I actually did plan for a 15-minute talk, so I cut out all the details. But you might be happy about that. And I'll. But please, you know, if there's anything you're specifically interested in, break through and let me know, and I might use the board here. All right, so first, I'm my two main areas of interest here: dynamics of the cell cortex and transcriptional elongation. I will make a little plug for the dynamics of the cell cortex, just so if anyone wants to talk to me about that, but I will focus on the transcriptional elongation in this short presentation here. But first, when it comes to the cortex, so I'm interested in the actomyosin cortex, and what you see here is a C. elegans embryo just after fertilization, and when it restarts here. So what happens is that you see myosin, and you see an overdensity of myosin to the left here, and that sets up a flow, and we try to understand this then in terms of these continuum theories. Another thing to notice there is that they have these little specks that seems to kind of interact and move around. So trying to kind of move beyond a continuum theory, we have been looking at in vitro systems here, and what you see here is also myosin in a background network of actins that's cross-linked. And you can, I mean, what you should correlate is the motion of these over here. I mean, this is obviously just qualitative at the moment. But what's interesting here is that you get these ordered motions in a system where, I mean, normally you would have polarity sorting would be the reason for what you'd see contraction if you look at microtubules interacting with bipolar motors. And we are now trying to understand this then in terms of the asymmetries of the material properties of the underlying network here.
What are you looking for? The white spots are...
There's myosin.
The label is myosin.
Yeah. The label is myosin in the background network of actin here. Yeah? I mean, there's a cross-linked, it's important that it's a cross-linked actin network. So it's not just fluidized by the myosin. And, I mean, this was then... I mean, you see something, you know, vaguely similar here, yeah? On a smaller length scale. I'm not going to say much about this, but also this network, I mean, trying to understand how the motors interact with each other here, and they're interacting through a network. It's also important to understand, you know, how you have relaxations in these networks. And we've also done some work on just the effects of transient linkers in these cross-linked biopolymer networks. But as I said, I'm not going to say anything detailed about this. So, all right, it's just pointing out here that we want this contractional events without polarity sorting. So instead, I'm going to talk about the RNA polymers.
But there is a polarity account.
Yeah, no, there is a polarity, but these are heavily cross-linked systems.
It's only work in one direction.
Yes, but the thing is that it's not sorting. You know, this is a heavily cross-linked system, so you can't actually... So if you have two microtubules and a directional motor walking around, you can imagine that they sort, you know, the heads are brought together, whilst here it's a heavily cross-linked network. You don't have that rotational degree of freedom of
so myosin. Actin doesn't turn, but myosin still goes in
the
same direction.
Yeah, but it's now a disordered network under. So if you're not looking at... Yeah. All right. So, but now back to the RNA polymerase then. So this is... I just find this a bit starch. It doesn't. All right. You missed out on a nice movie here of an RNA polymerase running along DNA, transcribing it. So the thing I wanted to point out with this little movie was that it's a very processive motor. So it can transcribe, I mean, it transcribes genes of 10 kilobase pairs without falling off. It's also does this very well. I mean, it only puts in an error every 10,000 or 100,000 base pairs. So we want to understand this machine performs what it does in it's a nanoscale machine, and it does this in a very stochastic environment, and we're trying to understand how it actually does, you know, how the biological function arises from the microscopics of this motor. So what's known about the RNA polymerase is that when it's transcribing, it's opened up a transcription bubble in the DNA, and it's then matching, it's starting to building an RNA strand coming out of this transcription bubble here. At the front of the nascent RNA strand here is an active site where nucleotides can come in, and they then base pair with the coding strand here, and then they can be catalyzed onto the backbone, and the process can go forward and like this. And if you see here, I mean, this seems like it would be just a normal exponential stepper if this is what's actually happening. But if you go back and look at the, they can actually follow these in single molecule experiments. They can follow these, the progression of these molecules as they walk along the DNA, and that's what you see here, position, time for different traces. And you can see this is not a simple exponential stepper. It has a very broad distribution of pauses here.
Why is it called exponential?
Sorry?
Why is it called exponential?
So it's just a constant rate of stepping forward, yeah?
Probability distribution intervals of one step. Yeah. How much time does it take to make one step?
Yeah. That's what the exponential. Each step is exponentially distributed.
Okay.
Each step is exponentially distributed.
It's moving forward at constant rate, so you're solving DTP equals minus KP.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So we and others have explained now this a broad distribution of pauses that you see. You see these very long pauses at the polymerase actually being able to slide into what's called a backtrack. It's a state where, I'm going to run this movie again, where the polymerase now, instead of actually keeping building RNA here, it slides backward, it diffuses around, and then eventually comes out and is able now again to resume elongation here. And that then gives a pause, and that's a simple first passage problem to come out back to this, and this will give you a broad distribution of pauses, as you see in experiments.
So what's the distribution experimental?
Three halves. I mean, that's three halves. It's only over a decade and a half, yeah. But then you have a T3 halves distribution of the pause time. Sorry?
Minus 3 halves.
Yeah, okay, so of course, yeah.
In a positive direction, and then a negative is...
This is very interesting because, it doesn't step backwards by itself, yeah? It's a directional stepper. I mean, it consumes energy as it takes a step, so it's irreversible step. That is. But there is a way of going backward.
The picture it was going...
Sorry. Yeah, no,
I'm talking about the experimental picture. If you show the experimental picture...
This, what?
Put a step back.
Uh-huh.
Experimental profile.
Okay. Yeah. No, this.
You can look at. Well, not that far.
No. It's a little bit slow here. I think I'm. Takes away time to react to the pressing of the. Yes, here should be an experimental picture soon. It goes backwards, yeah.
Yeah, this one.
Yeah, so you're talking about backwards here.
Yes, there's
some stuff. Yeah, no, so this is really, this is known to be sliding into one of these backtracks, where you actually pull it back, and then you go backwards. Without chewing up the chain, you're just sliding this, keeping the register, and the RNA is coming out the front here. And what we're saying now, and others are saying too, is that these pauses are actually the same too, but essentially sub-resolution. So you can't see that. Mm-hmm. And I might want to point out here, too, the reason why they're actually stopping here, all of them, is the fact that this is a fixed trap. So it's pulling, so it's an optical trap, and it's actually pulling two beads together. But the traps are fixed, so the forces are increasing as it's shortening the distance between the beads. Yeah. So eventually the forces are so high that it just stops the polymerase.
But the force, the velocity is almost constant up to the stop force. If you look at the slope...
The black ones.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the black ones?
Well, if you look, the slopes of these trajectories are velocities, right? So,
but you're talking about the black part of the trajectory, is it?
Black part.
Yeah, everything on average is just almost the same.
Even on average, it's the same, right?
Yeah, no. I mean, so this, I don't have them here, but you have real pictures. Oh, you're going to see some of where it's not the same. I mean, I'm going to show you.
No, because of the trap potential.
Sorry?
The slowing down because of trap potential.
Yeah, no, so what's happened is actually, no. So this exponential stepper I just talked about, the chemical step doesn't actually seem to be, you know, the rate-limiting step there is not on the reaction coordinate for the force. Yeah. So I'm not so surprised that these don't change. The chance of going into these backtracks that I would talk about, the polymerase is moving backwards, so that's along the reaction coordinate of the forces along the reaction coordinate. So these are... Yeah, I mean, these slide backwards here. So see here now. So this one should be forced abundant, for example. So at least, so now we have these. So these are then the long pauses. They get a long distribution. I mean, these pauses take up this whole trace. They slow down the velocity quite remarkably. So, you know, there must be a reason for all these things. If you just look at bare transcription now, this is now supposed to be, this is a DNA here now, the RNA that's building up.
You mean the reason for pauses? What do you mean the reason for that? The reason for what?
I'm looking for a biological function of these pauses now here. They really lower your transcription rate. They really lower your transcription rate, and transcription is something you want to have happening. Yeah. So that's what I was getting at. So now you have the DNA strand here now. This is a nascent RNA. This is now a nucleotide coming in, and it can bind. Obviously, there's more than one type of nucleotide, and it can also bind the wrong thing. And this discrimination here that we have in the first step, just by that you have a non-preferential binding between two nucleotides that are not matched, gives us an error suppression about 1 in 500 already here. Now, the average human gene is about 10 kilobase pairs. If you have a 1 in 500 chance of making the right, putting in the right base, you transcribing this whole gene correctly, you have a very, very small probability of doing that. So this, you need something more here to be able to do anything biologically. And this is then proofreading. And now assume that we'd be running this machine. We happen to put in an error at the first part of the hybrid. Now, I don't have it here, but there's a reason why this is now detected. It can be then go into one of these backtracks. And from here, with TF2S, which is the transcription factor in eukaryotes, this can actually be cleaved off and the error removed. Yeah? So with the backtracks, this is now a backtrack and cleavage off. We have, you know, this could be the reason then for the backtracks are allowed to take over so much of the transcription dynamics. So setting up a theoretical model, and this Tani has worked on this too. We have the polymerase sitting here. It can now, these are then a stochastic model we set up for this. It can slide into a backtrack where it can diffuse back and forth before it then frees up the active site again and can continue.
But this is pure unbiased diffusion, which means it is not affected by whether you made or you did not make a mistake.
This thing here, yeah. Now, the thing here is that you put in an error every 500, yeah? So, I mean, it goes past the first discrimination step, yeah? So in this, we're going to use mainly for calculating velocities, given that we have a certain amount of proofreading in the system, velocities on error-free sequences, yeah? And that will be a good approximation of the, you know, where the real sequences, because we only put in an error about every 500. So that won't actually affect the end dynamics very much.
So how do you use the error probability by backtracking? I missed that part.
So how it's...
If you do proofreading and you found a mistake...
So you have if a mistake is in. So now you have a hybrid that has this 8 or 9 base pairs long, and there's one bad base pair stacking in there. And it then bias to kick it out, yeah? Kick it out and move into this backtrack. So if there's error, it's more likely to move into backtrack. And once in its backtrack, it can be chopped off.
So that's the part of the text. So you're saying that going backwards, it's correlated with the seeing an error?
It's correlated with that. So if you have an error, it goes up. It goes up remarkably, yeah? Because you have a hybrid, and you have a bad base in one end, and you move into the backtrack, and the bad base matching is pushed out of the hybrid, yeah? So let me show you. So if this...
Could you clarify the mechanism of this feedback?
This selection.
No, when you make an error, why you stop? There must be some feedback.
This is exactly what I'm getting at here. So this is your DNA, and this is your RNA here. This is within the hybrid. If I have an error here, I'm going to put it like that. So this is now an error in the front here. I can now, so this energy is high of this state. And that will now, so depending on if I can now, from this state, I can move in, so I
match
the error in DNA. No,
right?
Not in the synthesis. Error in DNA itself. Some kind
no,
of
no, 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 no. Error in the RNA molecule.
Perfect. Yeah.
DNA is perfect. I mean, this is what I start with. This is a coding strand. I want to make a copy of that. So I presume that the DNA is what I want.
Okay. Yeah?
And now I'm sitting here, and then I have a preferential going down there just because the energy is high up here compared to here. So this is the selection mechanism. Then we can discuss, you know, how this error affects transition states in between these two, and, you know, if I'm increasing the error going down, rate of going down, or the rate of going out of the backtrack. These are details. But that's the basic underlying thing.
But then it's with some probability it detaches.
So it always has a probability to go into a backtrack, yeah?
Well, even without backtracking, you form with probability 1 over 500, you form an error in your RNA.
Yeah, so this happens with 1 in 500.
And then with some probability, you're going to cut it off?
To remove it out, yes.
And that probability is what?
Well, we will come. This is one of the things that we want to calculate, and you know we know.
What's the ratio of the two? You said it's 1 over 100,000, and you have 1.
Oh no, no. Okay, so it's about 1,000 is what we want to come out of this. Yeah. About 100 to 1,000. You know, this is all.
This is how you get a total of 10,000. Yeah.
Exactly. Sorry.
Why should the standard for an error for a mistake be higher than the right sequence?
That's the energy difference.
Yeah, are you asking why I'm selective to errors?
No, why the energy must be higher if you have an error?
Because it's not a proper Watson-Crick base pairing here. So this is a hybrid inside a polymerase.
The difference is roughly log of 500, the difference in energy.
Yeah, it's about 6 kT. Yeah.
I mean, the 1 over 500 is coming from basically that difference in energy. Okay, so.
Let me see if I've got it.
Yeah.
The polymerase protects whatever it has synthesized against the evil guy who's there, who's always chopping off the ends of the RNA.
This is a very good guy. Well, as you will have it by, you know.
Of course, I mean, it does a very good job.
So. Yeah.
Now, the polymerase sometimes slides backwards, so something that has already been synthesized.
So the cleavage.
And the guy comes and chops it.
Yes.
Now, mm-hmm. because it's. If you have an error, the polymerase cannot slide back, so just the wrong bit is hanging out there much longer than the good bit.
Well, why do you say cannot? So I think Tanning would tell you that it will
slide forward again.
With more probability, and then it cut off with more probability.
So I think
proofread mechanism, okay. Classical Hopfield linear.
I'm going to tell you that it's not classical Hopfield in a second.
Oh.
So I think this is where me and Tani would differ on this. That you would probably say that it's modulating the time it stays in a backtrack if it has an error. Whilst that would say it's actually the time it's more likely to go into a backtrack if you have an error in there.
Both of these things will fall into the class of. A generalized Hopfield.
I fully agree with you. No, sure. So that's absolutely true. But
it's more likely to go into the backtrack by how much? What's the ratio?
That's going to be about 6 kT too here. This is about what we expect for this. Because you have that error.
Another 1,000.
Yeah, so, but the thing is here now, so you have this, you know, convoluted scheme, and you can cut it off here. So now we have to use continuum time random walk theory to actually get the distributions of the transition times here. I have no time to go into that, though. But the thing being that you can get these very, very complicated paths, yeah? And this is something that you cannot get in Hopfield's classical prefrequency. So this is Hopfield, 1974. You have a six-inch. I would actually not, to some extent, I would hesitate to call this proofreading in its that it's, you know, pre-insertion selection. So you're actually looking at a base, if it's okay, I mean, you're consuming energy at all these checkpoints, but you can never actually, you check it several times before you incorporate it into the transcript. This is Hopfield's general scheme. You check it twice, now it's incorporated, you can never remove it. Yeah? And this is how it runs along, Hopfield schemes. Obviously, as I've just kind of argued for, is our polymerases are going to do this. It's going to run back and forth and do all these nested proofreading schemes. So we must move to something slightly different, yeah? Where we have this possibility of cutting backwards and going in
in Tibet, and why this is, you know, important.
If you minimize your process by extra couple steps, you're going to recover the other one.
Not always. I mean, as you see here, you have a polymerase here, just in this little simulation here, that is not going forward. Yeah? That could never happen in this situation. If I cut too much, this polymerase will stop being a polymerase and be a depolymerase rather. Yeah? And that's the point here. And I mean, so this is really, and I would say that many, you know, that much of the work that's been done here has completely ignored this fact. So actually, this here would be what you would classical Hopfield scheme, just using that without thinking about cutting. This would be the situation that you would judge as giving you the best transcript in the end. But as you see, it just cuts everything off and it doesn't actually transcribe anything. And the fact that you can be in this state, so here you actually have a transcription trace. It's biased into backtracking here by force. So force, we could see that as incorporating an error, essentially. You bias it into backtracking. And you see just this situation here where the polymerase is not progressing much. It's going into backtrack. It's getting cut out. It transcribes, maybe diffuses out of the backtrack there. Transcribes get into, cut out. So you essentially sit still, and if you pull harder, you can make this go backwards. And that could never happen in the first one. All right, so there's a competition going on here. You know, somehow, this backtracking is really good for lowering the error content, but it affects something. You know, but it, yeah. But there's something else in here. Yeah? So first of all, if we want to consider the efficiency of extended genes. So working under the assumption that a low number of errors is not good. Independent, if you have a small number of errors will destroy both the folding of long sequences and short sequences into protein later down the stream, meaning that I'm now looking at the situation where I want to communicate to you here is that if I have short sequences and I have a certain error ratio in that, most of the produced transcripts will be okay for being taken off. Yeah? If I instead have a very long sequence, then we're going to be many errors along these, and many of them are going to be wrong. Very few of these sequences are actually going to contribute positively to the cell.
Why is that?
Oh, because I want an error-free sequence if I want it to fold, essentially, properly, when it takes away, when it becomes a protein.
Well, the small errors, it depends where it is.
Oh, no. This I've completely ignored sequence here and these things, so, you know, there's certain redundancy in this, too, and that's all true, but that you should, in principle, just being able to take into account by renormalizing the gene length theory. So for this, I'm just looking, I want an error-free transcript. And if I can have two errors in it, then I will just say I want a transcript of the length. All right, so we were seeing that fidelity, or, you know, so we have two competing effects. We were just seeing here that errors reduces the number of functional transcripts I'm putting out, yeah? Or the proofreading increases the number of functional transcripts I put out, whilst on the other hand, it lowers the velocity of this polymerase. And this is then what we are arguing will set. So if you do all these calculations, you can now look at these processes, and you can look at them with error correction and without error correction. And then you can look at the production gains. Now I'm looking at the average human gene size here. I'm looking at the production gains of a 10 kilobase per length gene and as a function of the amount of proofreading down here. Now, this is actually one of the microscopic rates in the problem, but it's the backtracking. It's the rate. So in our model.
How often you step back?
Yeah, essentially, it is a backtracking rate. Yeah.
But then you can use the success rate of correcting an error per step back. That number is just 6 KT,
or what was that? So this amount of proofreading here is the rate at which you step back if you don't have an error.
Okay.
So this is, that's, you know, the basis.
100% if you have an error?
So, yeah, if you have an error, it goes up with this KT here. 6 KT. But this, I mean, that's, you know, that's a fixed parameter in the problem, you know, the energy cost for this. Yeah. So all I'm saying is now, in my model, the argument being that, for example, the rate with which you catalyze on basis to the growing transcript, it's dependent on early evolutionary choices for chemistry of template, the transcript and templates. The same thing with the cleavage. It's also due to the chemistry of now the transcript, actually. Whilst the backtracking rate, the rate at which you hop in these backtracks, is an internal parameter of the polymerase to some extent. Yeah. So this is a rationale why we meet out of the three parameters in a problem, and we're only varying one here. And so this is this backtracking rate that I've only called the amount of proofreading here. And so if you look here, you look at the production gains, what you notice is that burst, so you have a production gain, rate gain here. So this is a rate gain, and this is actually gain in the efficiency of nucleotide consumption, because when you cut off nucleotide, you're throwing them out, and they're lost. So first thing to notice is astronomical gains here is maybe not so surprising, given the probability we said of transcribing a 10 kilobase per gene without proofreading. What's interesting, though, is if you look at the average length of the human gene, in this region about one, so this is a backtracking rate, of a hopping rate in the backtrack of one a second. This is actually where you experimentally find this thing, too, the backtracking rates. So with this, I mean, I've left out many, many details here, but I want to leave with you that the proofreading lowers velocity but increases the chance of correct copying. You have to find a balance between paranoia and apathy here. I mean, that's what the graphs I just showed you was quantifying that. I mean, an error, a false positive, that I'm thinking that I have an error when I don't have an error, is fairly cheap. I go into backtrack, I cut it off, costs nothing, essentially. Yeah. There is some cost to it in terms of speed. So this would be, whilst on the other hand, if I have a false negative, it's extremely costly for me, or potentially extremely costly for me. And this is when, you know, how we, between these two things, this balance between apathy and paranoia has to be set. And in the end then, so irregular dynamics ensure that the transcription is fast when you look at correctly transcribed sequences, which is slightly counterintuitive maybe. And it's also another thing that comes out of this, that if I would want to, the longer the sequence that I want to transcribe correctly, the more irregular my dynamics has to be to do that. And that's something that would be interesting and try to actually go look at polymerases in different situations to see if this is actually fulfilled. So this was then my functional explanation for these things that you see here. Right, thank you.
You said it's non-hop filter. Could you just clarify once more what is non?
So actually the calculations come through the same way when you calculate the error rate. So that's completely hop filled. What is non-hop filled with it is taken into account that if you would do this normally the hop filled way, I would optimize my fidelity of the transcript by having a very, very high backtracking rate here. Very high. So every I would be extremely paranoid about errors. Yeah, you would be going into backtrack the whole time, just even if you don't have an error there. And that's, if you just do the Hopfield calculation, that's what it tells you. That's maximum in that region. Whilst if you want to take this cleavage into account, it shows you that in that region it's actually not a polymerase anymore. It's a deep polymerase. It actually moves backwards.
Can you reduce it to Hopfield by just slightly changing the terminology by saying that final attachment is something that happens when you are already beyond this point and do not backtrack anymore?
No, I would say you can't, because the Hopfield will never give you anything moving backwards. Yeah? If you incorporate it, it sits there forever. It's never coming out. It doesn't have these. It has points of no return in the scheme. In the other scheme, where you cut back, you don't have these points of no return.
I mean, I guess
so you can in principle return for arbitrary many steps backwards.
So sorry, I didn't get that.
In your scheme, there is in principle, with small probability, but there is a possibility to return arbitrarily far back.
Yeah, I mean, in certain regimes here, when I have, you know, where the classical Hopfield scheme would tell you that you're optimal, this polymerase would actually be moving backwards, is my statement. Yeah? It's not going forward.
So that's a difference.
Yeah, that's a real difference.
You move as many steps.
Yeah, you can cut and you can go back forever. You know?
So, but is that realistic, given the, for example, that you've got hairpins and...
No, but I mean, so I would say that your conclusion in the end of your paper, you're saying that this backtracking rate has to be quite high in order to be efficient. And my conclusion is saying that it has to be moderate to be efficient. So it does have a...
Yeah, but all I'm saying is that it's not quite right to say that you can go back all the way to the beginning, because actually the RNA...
You're talking about secondary structures.
Yes.
Are we talking about 10 kilobase per genes? Yeah.
So I guess the point is that, so because of the hairpins, I mean, I guess
hairpins?
I'm saying that
well, but that's not really, you know, that's in the discussion if they're actually influencing dynamics.
What I'm just saying is that I mean, what you thought, when you make the RNA, you're making a long chain of RNA that's hanging behind you.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it starts folding. You want to, one says that if it starts folding already, then you can go back maybe to some distance, but after a while it's going to.
But the point being here, though, that going back is, you know, a long distance is not reliant on going back a long distance within each backtrack. It's enough you go back a little bit, you know, before you hit these barriers that might happen 5, 6, 7 base pair back. And cut off. As long as you do that frequently enough, you will still move back as far as you want.
This is going to require a very high rate of backtracking.
Yes. I would term it as one would come to the conclusion that you want to have a very high rate of backtracking. Again, in the standard Hopfield schema. What I'm saying is that you don't want that because you're not producing anything. You know, there's an exponentially decreasing chance that you will actually transcribe the whole transcript.
But there's a comment. Sometimes people think about generalized Hopfield. Mm-hmm. So what you said is correct in the original paper of Hopfield. But it's an irreversible assumption between cycles. Yeah. If you take the reversibility, which you still do...
You mean you have a back arrow here?
Yeah.
Yeah, you have a back arrow, okay.
So that's how people talk about Hopfield keeping this in mind.
I would say that I would just make a comment here. I think there is one conceptual difference though between this and Hopfield, is the nesting,
This is the nesting that you go back.
Right, okay, more complicated chemical scheme. But that's the way the idea is the same.
The selection mechanism is exactly Hopfield, and I mean the calculation goes through exactly as Hopfield. Yes. It's just the point that you can't take it for granted. Yeah, this is.
I agree.
Yeah.
If you have a defect on DNA, for instance, a wrong pair, so you just transcribe what you get, or you can correct it.
No, I mean, this is not sensitive to this. It's just mashing with the coding strand.
Transcribe what you get.
Yeah, it's mashing. It sees the coding strand and then mashes it. Yeah.
May I ask some forbidden question?
Yeah.
For instance, when you were speaking about the cleavage, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you have any idea about chemical mechanisms, how it's actually done?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I know people do have. There's some magnesium ions moved in, and things are chopped off, and it all happens at the same site. So the polymerase is, the DNA or RNA polymerase is different from the DNA polymerase. The cleavage happens at the active site.
Okay, but the point is, the moment that you have hanging bridge here, they just attack the bridge. It doesn't matter. They don't know.
So TF2S is a molecule that has a long. Has a long spike sticking out of it, essentially going into the channel where the NTPs are normally into the polymerase, inserts there, and then, you know, puts this magnesium ions in the right place and do the cutting. So this is not, it can't act just freely on the transcript, just it has to be through the polymerase.
Sure. But they don't care about actually which kind of base...
If it's an arrow or not, you mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't.
If it hangs, then
it cuts, and this is the point. So these, I would argue that these are not due to errors.
Sure.
These are just due to being slightly paranoid about errors. Yeah. Or most, the majority of these.
Okay. So then it's physics, not chemistry.
Yeah. No, this is physics. Mm-hmm.
So how does it occur? I mean, I'm still missing the part of how does coming back and forth increase correct the error?
Well, being able to go into backtrack. Here, yeah?
Right.
So these are traces now without TF2S in them. So these are not being cleaved off. This is just demonstration of the dynamics. I had some very zoomed in version with these tracks backtracks with TF2S. If I can remember where it was.
Yeah. Just one sentence.
Yeah, no, but I have it here. I mean, so what's your question?
My question is, if I'm going back and forth and cutting,
yeah,
and creating again, whenever I create again, I still have the same probability of 1 over 500 of giving it wrong.
Yeah, but it's selective, so it's more.
Where is this extra?
So no, you're absolutely right. I'm as likely to put in an error again, yeah, but I'm more likely to take an error out than I'm likely to take the right one out, and that's the point.
So if
because of this, because it's biased into backtracking if I'm an error in there.
So you're saying the step backwards is more likely if I have
an error. So you're less likely to just go through an error than the right base. So if I have removed an error, no, it increases the.
And that's because of some physics of the.
Yeah, no, I haven't talked about here. I mean, this is then reliant on the assumptions of the transition state here. You know, either I'm increasing the speed in, or I'm decreasing the rate out. And that's a whole other discussion.
And that's the parameter you're optimizing in this axis when you're doing this.
The parameter I've optimized is a rate at which I, without an error, that I'm jumping between these states.
Where is the parameter of the bias? Because there's one.
No. So this is the same. This is the same parameter as was giving the bias in binding unbinding essentially. Yeah. Initially.
So the bonding probability of SysKT is the same probability of extra step backwards.
Or you can put that all in the step forward. I mean, that I can choose.
The symmetry of the steps between.
Well, I'm changing the transition barrier, so if it goes up one way, it goes down the other.
It's each of the barriers. So when you could either raise the bottom or bring down the top.
That's the difference for bonding. It's one thing, and the probability of moving is a different thing.
Right, but he's saying essentially what people say in chemistry, the rate of reaction is a kind of linear function of the free energy difference. So it's
Cramer's theory, basically. It's a Cramer's theory.
Yeah, it's a Cramer's rate.
What will happen if you, for instance, increase temperature or a physiological increase of temperature is so small it will be not noticeable or...
I don't think that would... So these are hopping rates of 1 a second, and I don't think that would be much noticed.
But generally, I mean, could you... You've probably been thinking about it. Is there something that can be improved here or worsened in terms of, you know, therapies or something?
Therapies or something.
I mean, proofreading better, you know?
There's a lot of transcription factors. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of... if I'm lowering the TF2S content here, for example... Then my errors go up enormously, and there's another thing. It's like in bacteria, you have NUSG, which is supposed to inhibit backtracks, to enable the enable the polymerase that produce more force and go forward and be more directed. So these things are actually controlled by the cell, these mechanisms. And I'd love to understand exactly how this happens here.